Mr. Falcone, thank you very much. We'll now call the Regulations Committee to order. First order of business is approval of the previous committee meeting minutes. Have already been distributed. Do we have a motion?
So moved.
Commissioner Hughes, second. Commissioner Morian, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Committee item number one, update on Parks and Wildlife progress in implementing the Land and Water Resources Conservation and Recreation Plan. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of things I want to share with y'all. We promised you at the November meeting we would come back with a quick update as to where we stood on the issuance of the water spinach cultivation permits. And I think our law enforcement team and inland fisheries team had a very productive meeting with growers over in Rocheron in December to kind of explain and walk them through the new regulations and how they were going to be handled. I think the best information that we have right now that we have had 30 growers approach us for permits. We've issued 12. We have another 18 that we are still processing right now. We've done inspections on, I don't know, 45 or 50 facilities associated with those proposed permits. By and large, we think the communication is going well. There's also some very standardized emergency management procedures that have been put in place, expectations as to what the growers will do in the event that there's some kind of a catastrophic weather event as well. So far, so good on that front, but I just wanted to give you a little progress that I think we're making some headway on that, again, thanks to the inland fisheries and law enforcement teams. A couple of new strategic purchases that have been made by the law enforcement division that I think are going to have really important benefits to the agency as a whole. There's been a new mobile command unit set up with state-of-the-art communications and satellite radio technology. Given the division's role in disaster response and emergency preparedness, we are frequently deploying large numbers of game wardens to places, and we need a state-of-the-art mobile command center to help communicate, and so very, very excited about that. Secondly, this may be the only way to get Pete Flores to issue a little bit of a smile on his face today is when he saw the new Cessna Turbo 206 that was purchased by the agency and we took possession of in December. And I want to say a word about that because, you know, that was something that almost every division inside the agency contributed to the purchase of. And so with law enforcement, so wildlife, our fisheries divisions and state parks kicked in. This is a plane that we desperately needed. You know, the average age of our aircraft fleet, and I use that a little loosely to refer to our two planes and two helicopters, is almost 30 years of age, and they are impeccably well maintained by Lee Finch and his team. But nonetheless, they're aging. And this new plane is going to give us a lot of help out in West Texas on our survey work out there where, you know, if Clay Brewer is out or Billy Tarrant flying looking at bighorn sheep in West Texas or doing patrols out there, we need to make sure we have a plane that can handle it. So we're really excited about this and ought to be ready to put into operation in March and look forward to the chance to get y'all out there to see that real, real exciting development on both fronts. Duck season ended last weekend, so it seems appropriate to say a few words on that front. I'm not sure if all of you are aware of our long history of partnership with DU Canada and, you know, a recognition by this agency and others that if we are going to take care of the country's waterfowl populations, we need to invest in the breeding grounds up in both the boreal forest and in the prairie provinces and the wetlands there. And so since 1985, you know, the agency, through the Migratory Bird Program, has invested $2 million in protecting habitat up in that area for breeding grounds, influenced, you know, well over 250,000 acres up there. And so and DU Canada has leveraged those dollars nearly 5-1. So I think we've seen a very, very good return on investment. We, in the last couple of years, have invested a couple of $100,000 a year. Next year, unfortunately, we're probably going to have to look at paring that back because of the obvious financial climate that we're looking at. But I just want you to know this is an important program that we need to continue committing to at some level. It'll serve us well. We really can't have any discussion about this because it's not on the agenda, but because it relates to waterfowl, I just want to say, so that you're apprised of this, some of you are aware of the big ExxonMobil spill on the Sabine Neches waterway around Port Arthur, in which we had about 10,000 barrels of oil that were spilled out of that collision. Our kills and spills teams from the agency and coastal fisheries and wildlife and law enforcement teams have been very active in working with GLO and others on this. We thought that that oil was pretty well contained with booms and the work being done by the skimmer boats. We are now concerned, though, but because of a number of factors, that we may see oil start to get into some areas on the Murphree Wildlife Management Area where we are wintering thousands of ducks. And so we're going to be prepared to take very, very quick action in the next couple of days if need be on that front, and I'll keep you apprised of that going on. So just something that's very much on our mind today as our colleagues in the field are out dealing with that. So, with Mr. Chairman, I think with that report, I'll turn it back over to you.
Thank you, Carter. Committee item number two, proposed rule review of Chapter 58, Oysters and Shrimp, permission to conduct rule review and publish proposed changes in the Texas Register. Ann Bright. Bring in.
Good morning. Good morning, Commission. For the record, my name is Ann Bright. I'm General Counsel, and I'm here with what fairly routine. We're required by the government code to review all of our regulations at least once every 4 years. We make sure that the reasons for adopting them continue, and then we also publish a notice of proposed review in the Texas Register in case the public also has comments on these chapters. And then at the end of this process, we either readopt, adopt with changes, or request that these be either readopted, adopted with changes, repealed, or based on this review. We've got one group of rules that are a little bit out of sequence. We're probably going to get them back into the regular cycle with the others. Some of you remember that we went through this a couple of years ago, but for various reasons, these end up kind of a little bit out of that cycle. We're now asking permission to review Chapter 58, Oysters and Shrimp. We're also requesting, because these chapters are actually in pretty good shape as a result of the fact that we do the statewide every year, we're also requesting permission to publish any cleanup changes in conjunction with the statewide hunting and fishing proclamation. And I think you're going to be hearing a couple of things about those today, such as separating out commercial from recreational, that sort of thing. And that concludes my presentation.
Great. Thanks, Ann. Any questions or discussion by the commission? Good. Thank you, Ann. No further questions or discussion. I authorize staff to begin the rule review and publish the proposed changes in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Committee item number three, 2010-2011, Statewide Hunting and Fishing Proclamation, permission to publish. I think we're starting with Robin Rikers. Morning, Robin.
Morning. Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, for the record, my name is Robin Rikers, and I'm here to present the coastal fisheries changes to the statewide hunting and fishing proclamation. Our first proposal that we scoped this year was, again, regarding the snook fishery here in Texas, which I explained to you last time, is really comprised of fat snook and common snook, and we were actually looking for an opportunity for more people, not necessarily have more fishing opportunity, but for more take of fat snook by lowering the minimum size limit on common snook. As a reminder to you, we're currently at a one-fish bag limit and a two-fish possession limit, and the current regulation sets the minimum size limit at 24 inches and the maximum size limit at 28 inches. What we were scoping was the opportunity to drop that minimum size limit from 24 to 22 inches, which, as I just indicated, would allow for some more additional take-home of fat snook, because they basically mature right in that range of 22 to 23, 24 inches. We felt like that would have minimal impacts to common snook. Since the time of your briefing book, publication of your briefing book, we've had our scoping meetings and gotten our public comments. At this point, we have 32 people in opposition to that. Only four people came out to support that notion, and of those 32, two of those people basically represented larger organizations, the Lower Laguna Madre Fly Fishing Association and the Snook Foundation. And basically their concern was that those minimal impacts, they were concerned about those impacts that we called minimal to the common snook population, and were concerned that, in fact, some of the progress we've made regarding common snook would be taken away if we went forward with this rule proposal. So at this time, staff would recommend that we remove this proposal from further consideration under statewide this year. We want to work with these groups and talk with them and look at, you know, some future strategies for management of this snook fishery, as well as any research opportunities that they may be able to help provide us with. So that's what we would recommend on this part of the proposal. Our additional scoping items, we had two of them. One of them was the strengthening of commercial reporting requirements. And as you remember, this basically was where we had some issues of, depending on how the sale was occurring, whether it was going from boat to person or boat to restaurant or boat to a dealer, who really was in charge of that reporting requirement. And so we want to make very explicit who's responsible when. And we also are including the inland fisheries landings that occur into our trip ticket system within the context of this publication of that rule. So we're trying to get that all under one umbrella. The other thing Ann just mentioned is the separation of the commercial and recreational statewide proclamation, and we're proposing to separate those into two distinct proclamations. No real change associated with the rules in that context, just pulling them apart from each other. In regards to comments in those two, or on those two items, we had two comments just saying they would like for us to find a more simplified reporting form. It is somewhat complex. We deal with a large array of species, and we certainly will look for ways to simplify that, and I'm not certain that we can, but we will certainly look towards that. The other one basically is a comment regarding, it's actually some fishermen down in the lower coast area who wanted to be able to group multiple days of catch and then sell them. And, of course, we've worked with enforcement, and there's not really a good way to do that without people getting over the bag and possession limits, or us not being able to enforce those bag and possession limits if we were to allow that. So our staff recommendation then is to forward those two proposals as we scope them to the Texas Register for publication and further consideration. With that, that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Robin. Appreciate it. Okay, I think next is Ken, moving inland. Ken.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Ken Krasowski of the Inland Fisheries Division. Although I'm with the Inland Division, the changes I'll be discussing with you concern fishing both freshwater and saltwater. We have some minor clarification to some of the wording in Section 65.72 of our statewide hunting and fishing proclamation. We have received occasional comments from anglers and staff on some of the wording in there, so we thought we would take this opportunity to clarify that. The wording isn't causing any major problems that we know of at this time, but we thought we'd take this opportunity to eliminate this possible source of confusion for anglers. And the bottom line here, we want to ensure our descriptions of bag and length limits can be easily understood as we move forward. Currently, the wording here in this one particular section that was causing the problem was the description of making it seeming you could interpret to say that it was unlawful to attempt to take fish where there were length limits in place. Certainly we have a lot of length limits, statewide limits for game fish, things like that. That wasn't the intent of that, and that certainly wasn't the way we were enforcing it. To clarify that, we're sort of separating out those two portions of that, separating out this to attempt to take fish in one clause and then the possession in another clause, so that should clarify that, make it easier for our anglers to understand there.
Sure.
Is there any questions on that?
Questions? Thank you, Ken. Appreciate it. Mitch Lockwood, you're up. Morning, Mitch.
Morning, Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Mitch Lockwood, and I'm the Whitetail Deer Program Leader. And for the last several months, I've been serving as a big game program director as well. At the November commission meeting, you'll recall that Clayton Wolf informed this committee of an idea we've been considering to open a mule deer season in two additional counties over in the Panhandle. And so at this time, we're proposing that change. To refresh your memories We have three different mule deer seasons in the state. Most of the panhandle has a 16-day season that begins the Saturday before Thanksgiving. Those 10 counties in the western panhandle have a 9-day season that also begins the Saturday prior to Thanksgiving. And then in the Trans-Pecos, we have a 16-day season that begins the last Saturday in November, which is always the Saturday immediately following Thanksgiving. If you look up there in the northeast, you'll notice Wheeler County does not currently have an open season. We propose a 16-day season there in Wheeler County. And then to the southwest, you'll see that Dawson County does not currently have an open season. And so we propose a 9-day season there in Dawson County. I should state that we do not have data that's indicating a rapidly increasing population of mule deer in these counties. In fact, we don't monitor mule deer populations at such a fine scale at the county level. Actually, we're aware that mule deer numbers are low in large portions of these counties because much of that country is in ag production where there's not mule deer habitat to speak of. However, there are some pockets of mule deer habitat in these counties where there are some mule deer that could be hunted, especially since we do offer a conservative harvest strategy of buck-only hunting that would not affect population recruitment or expansion. And so with that, we propose this conservative mule deer season in these counties in an attempt to offer some additional hunting opportunity without adversely impacting that resource. Now, since the November Commission meeting, Commissioner Hughes asked Director Smith for the Wildlife Division to consider whether or not there's any biological ramifications to beginning that Trans-Pecos season a day early. And again, to refresh your memory, in the Trans-Pecos, we have a 16-day season that begins the last Saturday in November, which again is always the Saturday immediately following Thanksgiving. So I believe the idea here is to offer hunters to take advantage, a little bit more advantage of that long Thanksgiving weekend by perhaps starting it on a Friday. And so I did visit with our field staff about that. I asked them to consider some potential biological ramifications, maybe some sociological concerns. What sort of public feedback would we expect? And after giving it some thought, staff certainly don't see or predict any biological concern from adding one day to the mule deer season. We really don't know what to expect in the way of public comment on this item because we haven't really had an opportunity to scope this yet. We haven't received this type of request in the past. Our field staff haven't heard landowners or hunters ask for some modification to the season, so we really don't know without soliciting some public comment on what kind of feedback we might get. I mean, it would offer create a new season structure, new for big game species or big game hunting, which typically would start on a Saturday and close on a Sunday. But again, biologically, we don't have concerns with an additional day. And so with that, I'm seeking the guidance of this committee as to whether or not we should include this rule modification to this proposal that would be published in the Texas Register and then set up some or schedule some public hearings out in the Trans-Pecos in the next couple of weeks to try to get some comment on this. And just to clarify, if we made this change and officially proposed it, what it would say is instead of the Trans-Pecos season starting the last Saturday in November, we would specifically say the Friday immediately following Thanksgiving, which but still end on a Sunday as it currently does. So it would go from 16 days to 17 days.
Mm-hmm. And can I give a little feedback on that, a little insight to the reason I see it?
Please.
I've been a long time landowner in West Texas and noticed over course of time that from particularly from a youth hunting opportunity, mm-hmm. it's very difficult for youth to get out on a 3-weekend season and shoot. All the major metropolitan areas, San Antonio, Austin, Dallas, Houston, are 6 to 12-hour drives to get youth out there on a Friday afternoon and back on a Sunday. A lot of my idea, and I actually wrote a letter to Lee Bass back in the early 2000s requesting this, saying, hey, it's hard for youth to get out hunting. Can we give another day over the Thanksgiving weekend of the holidays to get youth out, give them an opportunity to hunt, and then get them back for school starting on Monday? And that's kind of the idea here. You know, that let's create hunter opportunity, but hopefully particularly create youth hunting opportunity, give them an opportunity to come out. And if it doesn't affect the, if it's not a resource issue, I think it's something I'd like to see considered. Now MLDP in West Texas changed this to some extent, but there's still a lot of properties that are not under MLDP, and it should create some youth hunting and hunter opportunity that we're not taking advantage of right now.
Let's
Mitch, either one of you, is the rut timing in those counties such that if you opened the season the Saturday before Thanksgiving, would that not be helpful, or would that throw you out there too early?
Well, historically, I can say I think the rut normally starts after the mule deer season closes. I think it closes 16 days after it opens, which is usually around the 10th, 12th, 13th of December, and that's about the time that the rut starts, at least in the region that I hunt in West Texas.
I believe I can answer this one. If you get much tougher with your mule deer biological questions, I'll ask our mule deer coordinator to come help me out here. But I actually asked them to consider that. And what if we just start the same weekend that we start in the panhandle? And then the next question is, well, would it be 16 days still or 23 days? I should state that 23 days we're quite certain would receive much resistance from the public on that, remembering the days of going from 9 to 16 days in that area, and the mule deer MLDP days as well. And so with a 16-day season starting basically 1 week earlier than it currently does, then the next concern that we think hunters would have is what you just touched on. They would then, it would pretty much take them out of any opportunity to hunt the rut. Our season structure right now does allow for some years to catch the front end of that rut. There are some years where we may not quite catch it. But if we start a week early, we're fairly certain we'd miss that opportunity, and we're not sure that would be real popular.
Maybe we should just move Thanksgiving.
In the panhandle, of course, the rut is a little bit earlier. So that's why that season does start a little earlier, because we want them to catch a little bit of the rut, but not too much.
Well, I think it's very consistent with our mission, and makes a lot of sense as long as it doesn't have a negative biological impact. So I'm fully supportive of it. Any other discussion on that?
I got a question.
Please.
What happened in 2000 when you what did the commission do when your first suggestion was made? Do you remember?
I actually have a copy of a letter from Bob Cook. Bob, it was Bob.
No, was it Bob or Andy Sansom that wrote you back?
Sansom, yeah. And at the time, they cited low mule deer numbers in the Trans-Pecos, and that they were concerned about extending the season any days at that time.
On the switching from this Trans-Pecos issue to the Dawson and Wheeler counties. Mitch, you said that the department does not monitor the numbers on a county basis, but we know the numbers are low. How then can we say that there won't be any negative impact on the resource if we really don't know what's there?
Well, as you know, a buck-only harvest strategy won't restrict recruitment into that population and population expansion. A doe harvest certainly would. But a buck harvest wouldn't. A buck only harvest could potentially have an impact on buck age structure, where we could potentially have a situation similar to white-tailed deer in East Texas, where we now have antler restrictions because the hunting pressure relative to buck availability was too high to allow many bucks to reach maturity. So there could be some potential in those counties where this could have an impact on age structure. We're doubtful of that, but it's possible. But as far as population numbers growing, the buck certainly plays a role in that, but buck harvest wouldn't prevent those still from conceiving and producing young.
Should we consider as a part of the process of restriction or not?
I don't believe so, and the reason, Commissioner, for that is not only we don't only not monitor populations at that fine of scale, but we don't manage them at all at that fine of a scale. And so we're managing, as you know, with white-tailed deer by the resource management units, the RMUs, but we have some mule deer compartments, same concept in West Texas. In fact, we're talking the next year on how similar those are, RMUs and mule deer compartments. But that we have good data for a compartment. We have good population data. We have good harvest data for a compartment. We have good A structure data. And the A structure data there would rival the A structure data, as you recall, in, say, Shackelford and Throckmorton counties with white-tailed deer, with a very high proportion of the buck population being mature. And it'd be pretty hard to defend an antler restriction in that case. We could have a very site-specific impact, a very local impact on age structure in a county, for example, or a portion of a county, if there's 10 bucks and five of them get harvested every year. But for the compartment, we don't see an impact on that population. Does that make sense?
And then I have one other question. Why is staff proposing 9 in Dawson and 16 in Wheeler? Why not 9 in both, for example, if we're still concerned about the numbers?
Well, what we would like to have is, again, this is similar to our previous whitetail proposal by RMU. We believe that we need to have a consistent harvest strategy throughout an entire compartment so we can look at the effects of that harvest strategy on that population. If we have two different harvest strategies in one population, then it would be difficult to determine any impacts of either regulation on that population. And so in Wheeler County, I think it's pretty easy to justify a 16-day season. It's the Dawson County where one might think that there's a coin toss between 16 and 9 days. But as I admitted early in this discussion, we admit that there are low numbers of mule deer in Dawson County. And even though it's a buck-only harvest strategy, 9 days makes more sense for Dawson County.
Mitch, I have one more question, slightly unrelated, but in these, there are still counties closed in the panhandle. Can a landowner, rancher, manager apply for a wildlife management plan and get an MLDP in a county that's closed to whatever, mule deer or whatever it may be, or if they're closed, is it closed?
Well, we looked into that when we were in some Grayson County discussions last year, and if a season is closed to hunting, then mule deer permits may not be used in that county.
Other questions?
Yes, thank you. If I may take a little clarification on the front end in the Trans-Pecos, you referenced youth hunting, but I think what we're saying for the proposal is we wouldn't limit it to just youth on that Friday, would we? Or do you?
I don't think we would unless there's opposition to that on the commission. I think the answer is no.
Okay.
So we will go ahead and include that in the statewide package and put that out there for rural review and get public input on that and come back in March. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? Okay. No further questions or discussion. I authorize staff to publish the proposed changes in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Item 4 is Pronghorn Antelope Update. Mr. Billy Tarrant.
Chairman and members of the Commission, my name is Billy Tarrant. I'm the district leader for the Wildlife Division, Trans-Pecos District. I'm here today to briefly update you on the status of pronghorn in the Trans-Pecos Ecological Region. Since we standardized our population estimate in 1977, pronghorn estimates in the Trans-Pecos have fluctuated from approximately 5,000 to just over 17,000 animals. Typically, these variations are tied to habitat conditions and precipitation patterns. As you can see there in the late 80s, we had several years back-to-back of above-average rainfall and associated good fawn crops and peak numbers out at over 17,000 estimated. And then after the drought of the 90s, we in 2001, we bottomed out at just over 5,000 animals. started to climb back out of that hole with some favorable precipitation. And in 2008, TPWD Wildlife Division staff documented a significant die-off of pronghorn in the Marfa Plateau while doing surveys. We reasoned this loss of more than 2,000 animals was associated with basically 8 months without a drop of rain, followed by an unseasonably hard freeze in May. In 2009, we expected to recover somewhat from that drop with some reasonable reproduction based upon the habitat conditions. However, in that same area affected by the die-off, we recorded a 9% fawn crop last year. It's important to note that given the reproduction that we saw last year throughout the Trans-Pecos, we fully expect this next year will be a all-time low for numbers of pronghorn in the Trans-Pecos. Based upon these concerns, the Trans-Pecos Pronghorn Working Group first met in September of 2009. This group is composed of Trans-Pecos landowners, hunters, outfitters, wildlife veterinarians, wildlife biologists, and researchers all concerned with the status of pronghorn in the Trans-Pecos. Among other recommendations, this group recommended sampling hunter-harvested pronghorn and testing for mineral deficiencies and internal parasite concentrations. In spite of only having a couple of weeks, we managed to complete one of the largest pronghorn disease sampling efforts ever undertaken. This was a joint effort of Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, Wildlife Division personnel, Sol Ross State University, Borderlands Research Institute students, cooperating landowners, and outfitters. And I would like to especially thank the TPWD Wildlife Division folks that travel from across the state on short notice during their busiest time of the year to help with this important effort. We collected samples from 102 pronghorn from 50 ranches throughout the Trans-Pecos ecological area. We tested copper and selenium levels since these minerals can be related to reproduction. Selenium concentrations appeared about normal, what we'd expect. However, some copper levels that were recorded were very low, and this could be tied to high parasite concentrations. We also looked for internal parasites in fecal samples and the abomasum, or the forced stomach, that's present in ruminants. Of 82 abomasums analyzed, only 4 did not contain Homuncus contortus, or the barber's pole bloodworm. The average bloodworm total for all abomasums sampled was 510. And the highest number counted in a single abomasum was 4,080. If you look in the center of this photo, you can see a worm. That's a female worm with a typical barber's pole appearance. It shows a helix of blood that the parasite is consuming. This is a photo of a cleaned abomasum. Each of these red spots indicates a location where a worm was attached to the abomasal wall. As I understand it, even if this animal was treated and all parasites removed, each of these spots will scar and impede nutrient uptake. So thus pronghorn with high levels of homuncus are being affected both by blood loss and by decreased ability to uptake nutrients. Very little literature exists concerning homuncus concentrations in pronghorn. We do know that numbers above 2,000 per animal can affect health and survival in sheep and goats. Pronghorn managers understand the importance of our traditional recognized limiting factors such as precipitation, habitat quality and quantity, barriers to movement, and predation. This parasite appears to be an additional factor affecting population dynamics of pronghorn in the Trans-Pecos. However, relationships between parasite loads, climate, and habitat are not understood. Similarly, the effects of pronghorn movements and distribution on parasite numbers are not clear. We feel further research and surveillance are needed to determine causes and make appropriate management recommendations. In closing, these high numbers of bloodworms may be symptomatic of something that is missing in the habitat or changes in the climate. And even if it's not, there may be accepted habitat management practices that can help mitigate these losses. And at this point, we really don't know, and more research is definitely needed and surveillance to figure that out. Thank you for your time. Do you have any questions?
What are we currently contemplating in terms of further research? I mean, what's our plan?
At this time, Dr. Lewis Harbison, who's a member of the Trans-Pecos pronghorn working group, and Sean Gray, who is our new pronghorn and mule deer coordinator leader, have turned in a proposal.
Hey, John. Yeah, thanks. All right, yeah.
Have turned in a proposal with Dr. Ken Walbert with the Texas Health Services to look at kind of a more of a monitoring and surveillance situation, also look at fawn survival. We feel like this if these worms, one of the places, the times of the year that they really affect pronghorn is during parturition, and that's something that we seem to anecdotally notice through time, is that you see these fawns get up and run, and they're running, and then they disappear. And so need to look at fawn survival and also go ahead and test again. We will be testing again this next year. This is the coldest winter we've had in a while, and that may play some of it. We haven't seemed to have as cold a winter as we have in the past, and so we'd like to test again this next year just like we did before, and that'll be part of the research as well.
So right now we feel like we can adequately isolate these variables to come up with good science on it.
We hope. It's really an unknown. Chairman, I think since we've dove into this, it seems like the realm of parasitology and the realm of rain management don't often cross. And so we're kind of charting some unknown territory here as far as what the effects may be or what we can find. We're hoping to find some management practices or at least maybe something missing in the habitat that allow us to treat the situation.
Sure, Doug.
Am I right that this worm is a high prevalence in goats?
Huge, yes.
Do you think the increases in numbers of goats?
We you know, in historically in the Trans-Pecos, we had high levels of sheep and goats back in the 40s, and but since then we have not. We have a few in the areas where, well, basically, as you can see, we've had this isn't just a centralized location that where we have this problem. This is Trans-Pecos wide. And all you really have anymore are, excuse me, are house herds, show goats, things like that. Primarily, it's all cattle as far as livestock operations. So, and by the way, we are one of the things that we're doing right now is we're working with some counterparts with the University of Georgia to test this worm from a DNA standpoint and see what type of strain it is. At that point, we may be able to tell whether it is a sheep and goat strain or whether it's actually a pronghorn strain. And also that can tell us apparently the level of resistance it has to chemical wormers, because apparently these are really, really, really bad parasites that can adapt to wormers very quickly. And that's something else we're looking at.
And at the same time you're doing this research, are you going to look at other ruminants that may have the same? Because I think it exists in all of them.
It does. And in fact, this last year we went ahead and did kind of an informal sampling effort on mule deer in the Trans-Pecos. And I think our total was about 12 we've looked at, 12 or 15 mule deer, and we've yet to find it in any numbers at all. Just most of them had virtually none. And also, we just recently finished sampling did some sampling in the panhandle as well, and we did find some worms there. This was just last week, and we're not really sure yet what species those are. We think that they may be humongous in a different life stage, but regardless, the numbers were much, much lower. So,
thank you, Commissioner Rivers.
Actually, that was my question. Do you think we've gone beyond the Trans-Pecos?
We early on in this process, obviously, we had an idea which direction we wanted to go with sampling the Abel Masons, because we picked it up on some necropsies earlier in the year. And so I actually had requested information from all the pronghorn managers in other western states about this problem, because it doesn't show up in the literature very much. And it's interesting to note that there wasn't much to be said. Those folks that had those conservation agencies that had veterinarians on staff were concerned when we talked about it, and once we got our results to them, they were also extremely concerned. The fact that we will be presenting, hopefully, this year at the Pronghorn Workshop in Laramie, Wyoming, our findings. But Arizona now apparently has just picked up the reins and is going to do some sampling as well, so they obviously have some concerns too.
Mm-hmm. All your testing done on males, or do you have to harvest some females also and test them?
In the Trans-Pecos, we only harvested males. It was just hunter-harvested animals. In the, as I understand it, in the panhandle, we harvested all females. Okay. And, well, that's what's interesting about these results is that these are high numbers on animals that were, in theory, selected because they were healthy animals with, you know, they weren't sickly at all or... and still came up with extremely high numbers.
You may have said, but do we have a historical count on the number of worms in the stomach of the antelope, or is it the first
time? No, in 1967, actually, Tommy Haley did document Homuncus contortus in pronghorn in the Trans-Pecos, and we're still trying to track down that data. But it looks like he may have made a subjective call based upon, you know, none, very low, moderate, and high. And if there's any chance that he may have, back, we talked to him personally last week, Sean did, and if he has those numbers, I can't think of anything better to look at than some numbers that would be from 1967 till now.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add one thing to Billy's presentation. He was going to be joined today by John Means, who some of you know, who's a past president of the Texas and Southwestern Cattle Raisers Association. He's comes from a multi-generation ranching family out there in Van Horn, serves on our private lands advisory board. And John asked me just to convey to the commission he had a death in the family and couldn't make it at the last minute. But just how serious the ranching community and landowner community in West Texas is taking this issue. And he wanted to just impress upon all of us from his perspective just how dire a situation the landowner community perceives this, but also in a similar vein, how well the landowners are working with the department and Sol Ross on this, and how enthusiastic they are about continuing to cooperate with the agency on this, and are very, very pleased about how that is going. And from his perspective, just wants to make sure that the agency continues to prioritize this from a resource and a research perspective. And so John couldn't be here today to share that, but I wanted to make sure that you heard that from, again, one of our best and most respected partners and somebody who is absolutely an opinion leader in the cattle industry and the ranching community in West Texas about just how important this is to that community out there. So very, very pleased with the cooperation with our team out there and looking forward to us to continue on this.
Great. Thank you. Billy, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Did you
have another?
Good.
Sorry, I thought you had another.
Thank you. No.
Okay, item number 5, proposed new state falconry regulations, Raptor proclamation, recommended adoption of proposed changes. Matt.
Good morning, Chairman and Commissioners. My name is Matt Reedy. I am a regulatory wildlife biologist for a South Texas district. I'm also a falconer of about 12 years experience, so that's why they have me up here talking to y'all about the falconry program. The Raptor proclamation is what we'll be discussing today. In 2009, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service conducted an extensive revision of the federal falconry rules. In this, all states are required to comply with these new falconry rules as soon as possible. State rules may be more restrictive, but they cannot be less restrictive than the federal rules. Our staff with Parks and Wildlife has worked closely with the Falconry and Raptor Council to develop proposed new state falconry regulations. And to give you an idea, the falconry regulations have not been overhauled like this in 50 years. So this was a pretty big undertaking. The proposed new rules will establish standards for the capture, possession, housing, and use of falconry raptors, eligibility and application requirements for falconry, raptor propagation and non-resident trapping permits, identification of falconry raptors, transportation of raptors, sale of hybrid raptors and captive bred raptors, reporting, notification, and record keeping requirements. Before we really get started with comments, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Migratory Bird Chief, he reviewed our regulations, and also January 7th, 2010, they came out with some additional minor changes to the federal regulations. We published ours December 25th in the Public Register, December 25th, 2009. They came out with some more minor changes January 7th. So we had to then necessitate some modifications on our part. Some of those modifications include allowing apprentices to trap prairie falcons and ferruginous hawks. Those were not on the list previously. They now are. Then some other clarifications like banding requirements of certain species, facility standards regarding provisions of water to raptors. Previously, water was required, clean water was required for all raptors. We realize now in northern parts of the state, when water, where it freezes at night, having water there may be detrimental to the raptor at all times. So they backed off on that to where require having water where it's when it's necessary for them. Also, use of raptors in educational programs. Raptors can be used with a falconry permit for educational programs, and they can also be used for advertising of educational programs, but they cannot be used for commercial advertising. And then also the definition of the word imprint. The definition now stands as raptor that is 2 weeks of age, that is kept in captivity, isolation from other raptors at 2 weeks of age, and where it considers itself either a human or considers humans birds, like imprinting of a chicken. Public comments. We actually had several comments that came in last night and this morning, where a total of 32 comments in favor and 14 comments opposed to specific items, not to the whole thing, just specific items, and then one that was totally opposed. The one that was totally opposed reminded us that years ago we used to shoot raptors and was wondering why that didn't occur anymore, so we kind of look at that totally opposed as a, one of those. But the 14 comments opposed to specific items is what we're really more interested in. It's broken down a little more. Five commenters misunderstood the proposed rules. Four commenters requested non-substantive changes that staff agrees with. They were just little clarifications. And then three commenters requested changes that were prohibited by the federal regulations, so we cannot be less restrictive than those. Some of the things that the staff disagrees with as far as the comments, one commenter stated that the state has no authority to regulate abatement activities, abating of depredating wildlife with trained raptors. The state does have the authority to regulate abatement activities. We have the authority to regulate hunting and harassment of wildlife, therefore we have the authority to regulate that. There are federal abatement regulations out there as well. Another was that falconers should be allowed higher bag limit during open seasons for upland birds. That sounds like an idea. We actually would like to further scope that with the Falconry Raptor Council as well as the Upland Game Bird Action Committee. So we'd like to table that for now and maybe discuss that later. Another comment was limiting trapping season for kestrels, American kestrels during the breeding season. We feel like that's not an issue. Raptors can only be trapped at less than 1 year of age. Those birds are not breeding birds at less than 1 year of age. So there's not really a conflict with the breeding birds because we're not allowed to trap breeding raptors older than 1 year of age. And then another comment was to continue to allow paper reporting. We are requiring all electronic reporting of acquisition of raptors, loss of raptors, things like that. We'd like to continue just allowing only electronic reporting. The feds require now electronic reporting entirely to limit paper movement, things like that. We'd like to stick with just electronic reporting since personal computers and internet access is pretty prevalent across the state. Some of the comments that the staff does agree with. Oh, wait. I forgot two ones that were added this morning. That the staff disagrees with. One of the comments was to disallow apprentices' use of Cooper's hawks. Cooper's hawks are also on the list to allow apprentices. From a biological standpoint, the number of birds that may be taken is minimal. We don't see really an issue with that. Overly regulating the falconry community. Another one was to disallow unannounced inspections by game wardens at falconers' facilities. We do realize that game wardens. We do realize that game wardens, if with probable cause, can enter to a premises. So we disagree with disallowing unannounced inspections. Some changes that staff does agree with: allowing abatement subcommittees to act without direct supervision of the primary permittee, to allow abatement groups to do their jobs. They have subcommittees that can use those raptors, so they can the primary permittee can send his employees out to do that work, and he doesn't have to be on site during that time. So they can have several sites working at the same time. Another request was to allow apprentices to trap ferruginous hawks. With those new federal modifications, apprentices are now allowed to trap ferruginous hawks. So that was taken care of. And then one was to retain the current temporary transfer rule. Currently, with our current regulations, another falconer can temporarily care for someone else's bird for 30 days with a signed and dated letter and then a copy of their electronic acquisition form. We would like to maintain that, where it's just a 30-day window like that, so that it's much easier for for wardens to check on that and for falconers to understand what's going on. And that is, recommendation is Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopt the repeal of 65.261 through 65.267 and 65.269 through 65.277 and adopt new 65.261 through 65.277 concerning the Raptor Proclamation with changes necessary to the proposed text as published in the December 25th, 2009 issue of the Texas Register. Be happy to take questions.
How prevalent is the abatement with Raptors process?
It's growing. I'm not sure how many there are. I can get that information for you. We don't require a permit through the state. It's just a federal permit.
Right.
And we'll probably get that information for you, but I don't have it offhand. But it's, I'm pretty sure it's a growing segment.
I think it's a fascinating idea. I was just curious if it's on the upswing or...
It seems to be. With this, the new abatement federal permit came out, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, so it's just kind of starting to gain momentum.
Also be fun to watch.
Sure, Douglas.
Thank you.
Commissioner Hickson could not be here today, but she asked, she passed along a couple of comments from a man named, or I assume it's a man, Sheldon Nicole, N-I-C-O-L-L-E.
We have received his comments two other times as well. And I spoke with him on the phone yesterday.
Did you get these same observations about some perceived ambiguity? And
I believe so. If you don't mind reading them to me to make sure we
I'm
have
not
them.
Pushing his agenda. I just wanted to mention one of them that I think may have some merit.
Okay.
Over on page 177 of our books, the under 65, proposed 65.267A5, where it says an apprentice falconer may conduct abatement activities under the supervision of a master falconer. If you go over to 263D on page 173, it's up in the upper right-hand corner where there's a definition for direct supervision.
Mm-hmm.
Do
we have a clarification. That is the clarification on here on this page, that allow abatement subcommittees to act without direct supervision of primary permittees. We're gonna fix that. And to allow apprentices as well as general falconers to act without that direct supervision as for the abatement activity. So we have acknowledged that.
Okay.
That comment.
Let's see. And then I think over on page 181 of the book, under proposed 65.268, little four, there's a it's a question raised about what's meant by in the aggregate there. And I understand you may be clarifying that.
That was that we're going to the way the proposed rule was to an aggregate is very confusing as far as a temporary care of someone's raptor in the aggregate certain number of days. We've decided to remove that aggregate and just it's a 30-day temporary care transfer. That's it. Nice and simple. We've spoken with law enforcement. They would prefer it to be a nice and simple 30 days. That's what you have. No aggregate to worry about later down the road.
Okay.
So we've acknowledged those comments as well.
Good. Thank you very much. That's all I have.
Any other comments, questions? Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. And that concludes the business of the Regulations Committee. Now move on to Conservation Committee, Chairman Bivens.